This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 6 weeks after he was elected president, Barack Obama said, "I think the whole election was a novel." The cast of characters was indeed compelling. A barely known African American first-term senator, a former first lady, and a maverick war hero with a penchant for risk. Taking. Veteran political journalists Haynes Johnson and Dan Balls offer new insights into the historic 2008 campaign in a new book. It's titled The Battle for America 2008. Both men join me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning,
and welcome.
Diane. Thanks, Diane. We're glad to be here.
You know, as the president said, I think the whole election was a novel. Your book reads like a novel because it is so fascinatingly filled with the details of what each person had to say and do. You actually started research on this in 2006, Dan.
We did, yes. We started in late 2006, and in early 2007, we actually joined forces. Haynes was thinking about a book about the campaign, and I was independently thinking about a book about the campaign, and we got together one morning. Haynes called me and said, "I have an idea I want to talk to you about." I didn't know what it was. I went home that night. I said to my wife, Nancy, "Haynes called today, wants to talk about something." She said, "If it's about a book, just say yes."
Well, it was because you both believed that the election of 2008 was one of a lifetime.
That's why we did the book, Diane. It wasn't just another book on politics, or even though it's a great story, but this had so many elements to it. The state of the country, the future, the American political system, the standing of the Bush presidency, which is sinking like a stone in this period, Obama, all these characters. It was like a novel, except it was real, even more powerfully so. And we just had a heck of a time trying to tell this story. It was a great experience for us as journalists, as writers.
You know, it's interesting that you point out that focus groups in 2007 really had bad feelings about where the country was.
No question about it. I mean, that was one of the things that was driven home to us very early on. As Haynes said, President Bush's approval rating was dropping rapidly, dropping to 30% and even below that. And Peter Hart conducted a series of focus groups that we attended. And early on, it was clear how much discontent there was. And it was across the board, Diane. It wasn't just Democrats who were unhappy with the state of the country. Independents also, as well as Republicans. Republicans were unhappy with their own party and increasingly with their own president. You had a combination of discontent over the war in Iraq, an economy that was beginning to go south. It collapsed much more later in the campaign, but even then, there was nervousness about it, rising health care costs. The Katrina episode had convinced people that government wasn't working and didn't work. And so as we started this election, it was clear that people wanted something different. They wanted change. They wanted a new direction.
And despite all the changes that were going on among people looking to, there was really a feeling ideologically, it didn't matter whether you were a liberal or a conservative, they felt the same thing. That didn't mean they wanted Obama or they wanted X or Y, but they wanted change.
And, of course, Barack Obama was relatively unknown.
He was relatively unknown. It's curious. He was relatively unknown in terms of a potential president. He was clearly known within the Democratic Party as a rising star. I think so many people remember the speech he gave at the Democratic Convention in 2004.
That blew my mind.
Which just launched him as a comer. But nobody anticipated at that stage in early 2006 that he was likely to be a candidate by the end of the year.
Why did John Kerry choose Barack Obama to make that speech?
Well, he had heard Obama speak at a rally in Chicago when he was looking for somebody to be a keynote at the Democratic Convention. He was impressed with what he heard from this young, not well-known state senator from Illinois. He wasn't even a U.S. senator at
that point. How much self-confidence did Barack Obama have giving that speech, Dan?
An enormous amount of self-confidence. That we recount several anecdotes in the book, some of which we took from other reporting that people had done, David Mendel of the Chicago Tribune and Ryan Lizza. In each case, there's one moment where David Mendel of the Trib is following him around. It's the day of the speech, and he said, well, how do you feel about this? And he said, I'm LeBron, baby, which means LeBron James, the hot young pro basketball player. And as he was going out to give the speech, he's standing with David Axelrod, and we were told this later, his chief political advisor. And Axelrod and Robert Gibbs, his communications director, are standing there. They are nervous for him because, in fact, some of the rehearsals had not gone well for that speech.
Right.
And they had to tune him up for that speech.
He had to be coached.
He did have to be coached.
Yeah.
That's right. They brought in a speech coach, one of the best in the Democratic Party, and he got him to the point where he could really deliver that speech. But Obama turned to Axelrod there and he said, tapped him on the shoulder and said, don't worry, I will make my marks.
The self-confidence is there. All politicians believe they are the best and they're going to do this. Nobody runs for president without having enormous confidence in your ambition, your future, so forth. But Obama struck me, and I don't know if Dan agrees with this or not, as the single most confident person I've seen in public life.
But he wasn't always that way. During the campaign, he had some great doubts.
That's right. And that's what's really fascinating as you get into it, because there was this one side, this self-confident, cool, cerebral, incredibly ambitious politician. And yet, during his campaign, he was frustrated. He was having trouble. His campaign wasn't working well, and he was turned off by it. I mean, that's the other conflict when you get inside and see what was happening. That wasn't the Obama the public saw.
Remind us of what happened in Selma, Alabama in 2007, Dan.
This is such a wonderful story, Diane. This is a couple of months after both he and Hillary Clinton had announced their candidacies, and it is the first time they are together. It is a ceremony to commemorate the Selma March from 1965. And Bill Clinton is there, Hillary Clinton is there, an array of civil rights leaders. And Obama gives a very good speech, and the day goes very well. They march across the Pettus Bridge, arm in arm. He goes back to the airport to head to a fundraiser in Boston. He's got a small jet. And he and two aides are sitting on the plane. And they notice first this motorcade of SUVs come roaring up. It's one of the Clintons. They then notice a second motorcade. It's the other Clinton. They're sitting on the plane, and they are told, the battery's dead. We can't start. So they're sitting on the plane, and first one of the Clintons takes off, and then the second Clinton takes off in big, big Learjets. And Obama's sitting there, and they tell him, you know, we're going to have to go to Birmingham and get a battery. So you're going to be here. They are sweltering on the plane. It's air conditioning, not air conditioned. And Obama turns to his two aides, and he said, well, I guess this really is a grassroots campaign.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's how it began, with nothing, literally nothing. I mean, this is.
They had no website. They had no money. They had no staff.
Very little organization compared to the Clintons or anybody else who was running for president at the time. That's what's so incredible. We say in the book, he was the most unlikely person to be president of the United States ever. And the fact that he got it said a lot about the country, the issues, but about him, too.
The day he put up on his website that he was forming an exploratory committee, Steve Hildebrand, who's a veteran organizer, was heading into Iowa to help organize Iowa. And the first thing he did once he got to Des Moines was to go to a a cell phone store and buy a cell phone with a local area code. Phone that into Chicago. That was the Iowa campaign headquarters number, though they didn't even have an office at that point.
And we're not even talking about the race question or any of that or the lack of experience.
Not yet. Not yet. Yeah. Now, was he truly, that is, was Barack Obama truly honest and straightforward when he told Tim Russert in 2006? He answered the question, no, when asked whether he was a candidate.
Yes, he was, being straightforward. He was troubled by, at that point, he hadn't made up his mind and so forth, and he was thinking about it, but he hadn't decided. That really was true. And also, he didn't think that he was going to be the person that would do it at that point. Then, as it went on, more and more attention to him, more and more clamor. He gives the great speech to the Democrats, and all of a sudden, he's a star, and he's having to sort of figure out, yes, I am going to run. He wants to be president. The question is when and how and when. How? And so he decides, he goes on Russert again 10 months later, and Tim, typically our dear friend, sadly not with us anymore, and Tim looks at him and asks that question. So I asked you last time, are you going to be a candidate? He said no. And this time Obama said he was thinking about it.
But the remarkable thing is, even in that week in January of 2006, when he is saying, I am not going to be a candidate in 2008, there is a memo that we unearthed, prepared by his then Senate Chief of Staff, Pete Rouse. And in that memo, Rouse says, in the event that there is a perfect storm that comes together that allows you to run in 2008, we should begin to use this year to prepare for that. So even though nobody around him believed it was going to happen, they were preparing for the eventuality that it might.
Haynes Johnson and Dan Baltz together, they've written The Battle for America, 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election. And the book is dedicated for Tim Russert, friend and colleague who defined the race only to miss the last chapter.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, the nation's prospects for a jobless recovery. We explore whether the recession can really end if people can't find work. And local experts weigh in on whether our region's job market may actually be poised for a rebound. Plus, staying healthy on the job. Workplace consultant Howard Ross examines the cultural factors that determine why some people expect more of their employers and their health coverage. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
New York State Thruway is closed, man.
In the summer of 1969, a music festival that would rock the world in more ways than one unfolded on farmland in rural New York State.
I don't think we told any lies, but we certainly did not prepare them fully for what eventually assembled.
This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place.
Listen for the music and the story of Woodstock on Back to the Garden, Woodstock Remembered.
Tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking about the extraordinary election of 2008. And Dan Baltz and Haynes Johnson, both of the Washington Post, and Haynes Johnson is Pulitzer Prize winner, the author of 14 books. He now holds the Knight Chair in Journalism at the University of Maryland. Dan Baltz is lead political reporter for the Washington Post, and their new book titled The Battle for America, 2008. Here's a question for you both from Linda here in Washington. She says, stripping away the characters in the 2008 election, please give us your opinion on the nation's readiness for a woman as president versus the nation's readiness for an African-American, Dan.
It's such a great question, and I think that had you been at the beginning of the 2008 campaign, people would have said perhaps the country was more ready for a woman than for an African-American. That turned out not to be true, but I'm not sure that it is because the country was any less ready for a woman. I think it was a combination of the kind of campaign that both then-Senator Clinton and then-Senator Obama ran. I think it was that Obama was able to capture the moment and the mood of the country more effectively than Hillary Clinton was able to do. There's no question that at the end of the Clinton campaign, there was a lot of disappointment among women and a feeling that in many ways she was badly treated by the media in particular, but badly treated elsewhere along the campaign trail. There is some probable justification for that, but I think that's not the reason that she lost and Barack Obama won.
Haynes Johnson, did Barack Obama consider Hillary Clinton to be more ready to run than he?
Yes, I think in some ways he did, as a matter of fact. He knew she was experienced, admired her very much. After all, the Clintons had won two White Houses back-to-back, no Democrat since Franklin Roosevelt. They had all the organization, all the money, all the expertise, and all the help. So she was the dominant figure when that campaign began. But as Dan says, Obama had this ability to read the mood of the country, how troubled it was. And also, we haven't mentioned the fact that the war in Iraq was there. And she was trapped in this support for the war resolution, where Barack gave these great speeches about the war. And you go back and we quote them at great length because they are so prescient. You read the speeches he talked about in 2002, before the American invasion, or whatever you want to call it, in Iraq in 2003, and they are incredibly prescient. It wasn't that he was supporting Iraq or whatever, but he knew that we were going to be in trouble. The long-term consequences would be very serious, and he took his place right away, and Hillary never did.
Talk about David Axelrod's role in this whole campaign from beginning to even now.
Well, David Axelrod is one of the two most important advisors in that campaign. He's a transplanted New Yorker, grew up on the Lower East Side, moved to Chicago, and is now probably the most prominent Democratic consultant in Chicago was at the time that he and Obama came together. They joined forces in 2004 when Obama was running for the Senate. And I remember sitting in the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee during the 2004 primaries, the Wisconsin primary, and Axelrod was doing work for John Edwards. And he said to me, "You should watch for Barack Obama. He is coming forward." Axelrod knows his candidate as well or better than anybody around him. And they have a level of trust. And there is a memo that we have in the book that he prepared in November of 2006. It is a prescient memo. It is also a very tough-minded memo. It's prescient in the sense that he understands why it's Barack Obama's moment to run. It is tough because he says to Obama, this will expose you to something that you are completely uncomfortable with, which is criticism. You do not take criticism
well. Because if Barack Obama had written in his own book about his drug use, for example, and Axelrod warned Obama that his confessions of drug use would be used against him. And then he ends by saying, "At the risk of triggering the very reaction that concerns me, I don't know if you are Muhammad Ali or Floyd Patterson. When it comes to taking a punch, you care far too much what's written and said about you. You don't relish combat when it becomes personal."
I really believe years and years from now, people are going to look back at that particular memo, and it captures exactly the promise and problems of Barack Obama as he's entering the stage. And it helps you understand his problems. He couldn't take a punch, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, he had this great opportunity to run. And the political consultants are going to be studying the candor of that and the reason it was written. It captures exactly where Obama was.
But how do you then place Obama now in the midst of this really brutal health care fight?
Well, there's so much that we learn about Obama in the course of doing the research for this book that I think is applicable to today. This is somebody who has, as we've said, great self-confidence, great determination to succeed, big ambitions, but also somebody who whose ambitions sometimes exceed his ability to pull them off. And starting out running for president, he was not an effective candidate. He stumbled. He had bad events. He was unhappy. I think we're seeing some of the same thing in his presidency right now. He's in a huge battle, particularly over the healthcare fight. And one of the things we know about Obama is that he has a sense of patience, that he has resilience, and he has the ability to learn from his own mistakes. And I think what we will see as we go from now August into September and October is the degree to which he's able to make sort of mid-course corrections in his own style of governing to try to pull off these
fights.
What
kind of mistakes do you think he's made in this health care fight?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is there is a question now about how much government Barack Obama is asking people to swallow. They have had to do extraordinary things because of the economy, but it has resulted in the injection of a huge amount of money into the economy and a huge amount of government control on aspects of the economy. Now they're taking on, 15 to 20% of the economy and dealing with health care. And I think there is a skepticism on the part of a lot of people about whether government is up to doing all this. He is going to have to figure out a way either to scale back on the role of government in this healthcare fight or convince people that government is capable of doing what he wants to do.
One thing that we're going to do tomorrow is to try to separate fact from fiction in what's out there. Some of these town hall meetings have been disrupted and people have been making claims. And I think it's important to sort out the fact from fiction.
Oh, absolutely. And what you're seeing right now is the anger in the country, which is genuine, and also the manipulation of public opinion, which is also real. And one of the things that's fascinating looking back at Obama is his poise, his confidence. He ran on the slogan of change, which is the oldest cliche in American politics. But he really believed he wanted to bring the country together in the divisions. We're now seeing them boiling up. That's going to be his great test. Can he reach beyond this and say, look, we've got to get together. This is important for the future. And I don't know, that's his great test of leadership, don't you think, Dan?
Yes. And Diane, I think there was one large unresolved question about Obama during the campaign. And I think it is one of the reasons we're seeing some of what we see now. He was such an inspirational candidate on the campaign trail, with the promise of moving the country past a lot of old divisions, the red-blue America, the battles from the 60s that continued on into the 90s and even the Bush administration. And so on the one hand, he was a candidate who promised to make consensus where consensus had not existed. On the other hand, his agenda was a very ambitious agenda that tilted in the liberal direction. This was not a moderate agenda. He never had to square that circle during the campaign. I mean, that's one of the beauties of campaigns. You can kind of blur the line sometime and to try to build a coalition for victory. When you govern, you have to make those choices. And
indeed.
And he's had trouble being both of those people as president.
Haynes Johnson, how did Barack Obama win Iowa?
He won it because he understood the caucus state as opposed to the other kind of states where it was just for voting. And he had a campaign that we haven't seen in American politics. They organized, they crossed the state, they were not the conventional. They understood the new arithmetic of how to do it with money, but they had people. Young people flooded the state, and the Clintons never got Iowa, and they lost that state, and they were doomed. Well, not quite doomed, because they came back quickly and won New Hampshire, but it was a tremendous setback.
At one point, wasn't there a rumor that Hillary was not going to go to Iowa?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they even would talk to some of their people, urged them to stop, not go to Iowa, and concentrate on the other big states, and they didn't do that. It turned out to be not the right idea.
Did not Bill Clinton advise Hillary to go negative when, especially, they got to South Carolina?
Absolutely. Bill Clinton and Mark Penn, who was the chief strategist in the campaign, had argued for a long time that they had to take on Barack Obama, that they should not let him get ahead of steam, if you will, that they needed to go after him. They were arguing this in the late fall of 2007.
Well, what would that mean, going negative?
Well, I think it would really, two things. One is to, they felt that his position on the war was fuzzier than he was making it, that he had, yes, opposed the war at the beginning, but as a senator, he had voted to continue funding the troops.
Right.
He had not taken a strong stand against the war. They wanted to expose that to harsher criticism. They felt that his inexperience made him vulnerable, and they also believed that, in essence, he hadn't been fully vetted. I mean, that there might be things that would come out about him during the course of the campaign that would make him vulnerable to attack by the Republicans. They tried. Now, it's amazing to us that the former president and spouse of the candidate and the chief strategist were arguing this, and they didn't win out in that argument. I mean, that, in other words, that she would begin to go negative and then pull back. And so it never happened. It did happen in South Carolina, and they paid a big price for it.
What was so interesting about South Carolina, we talked about Iowa before. When Iowa went so for Obama, here is an all-white state. And many blacks who really wanted Obama, but they thought he could never win. A black couldn't win. Therefore, they were for Hillary. We ran into people like that in the focus groups who said that they were for Hillary, but really their preference would have been Obama, but they didn't think a black could win. When they saw an all-white state virtually go for Obama, that opened up the allegiance of many African-American voters, and they never lost it. That was a great blow for Hillary.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But when they got to South Carolina, that's when Bill Clinton started getting really tough.
The interesting thing, Diane, is that nobody in Clinton's campaign, other than Bill Clinton, wanted to really contest South Carolina. They realized after Iowa, as Haynes said, that the African-American vote was now consolidating around Obama, and they wanted to do as little as they could there to downplay the significance of it. Bill Clinton had another view, and that was he had ties in the African-American community, and he wanted to go make a fight out of it, and he did.
He was considered the first black president.
Exactly, exactly.
This is why it's such a great novel. Oh, it's a real story. I mean, these characters, the Shakespearean level of it, kept changing. And we as journalists, writers, authors, were stunned to watch this thing and entranced to see it go back and forth.
And when did Hillary herself shake up her campaign staff?
Well, that began literally the day after Iowa. The morning after Iowa, there is a conference call, and Hillary's on it, and she asks, in essence, what should I do? What do I do at this point? And her chief advisors are tongue-tied. They can't come up with anything. They have almost nothing to say. One person who was listening to the call said to us later, it was sheer negligence on the part of her campaign team. She hangs up. She finishes the call by saying, thanks, I've enjoyed talking to myself. And at that point, she is getting tons of advice from people outside the inner circle saying, you've got to shake this campaign up. And literally on the morning of the New Hampshire primary, this was a day when people woke up thinking Obama was going to win fairly handily, Patty Solis Doyle, her campaign manager, receives an email on her BlackBerry from Senator Clinton saying, I've decided to make a change. She wants to move Patty Solis Doyle out as campaign manager. It took a month for that
to happen.
Put Maggie Williams in. That's right. Maggie Williams, who had served Hillary Clinton in the White House. It took a month for that actually to happen. In that month, you basically had what I've referred to as almost a collective breakdown of the Clinton team. They were fighting with one another. They were looking over their shoulder. They didn't know how Bill and Hillary Clinton were going to respond to this. And at the crucial moment when strategic decisions meant everything, they were not at the top of their game, and the Obama campaign was.
And don't forget, she came in third in Iowa, not just second, not just first. She came in third. So at that point, there's a real disaster, and they got to figure out what to do. And Hillary is alone, virtually, among her advisors at that point.
Was there anything comparable going on in the Obama campaign, or was that absolutely, sharply, clearly defined?
Well, no campaign is trouble-free. But the Obama campaign had this motto, No Drama Obama, which came from the candidate himself. I mean, his view was, and he instilled this in people from the beginning, we are going to be collegial and we are not going to air our differences in public. And they were remarkably disciplined about that. It's not that they didn't have disagreements. It's not that there were not moments of stress. There were times that we recount in the book that Obama himself called the team together and said, if we continue on the path we're continuing, this was in the summer of 07, for example, we're going to finish second in Iowa. And that's not good enough. We've got to finish first.
And then Senator Ted Kennedy came on board.
Well, that's the most dramatic thing in the book, I guess, I suppose, and the most tragic in some ways, because here's Ted Kennedy, the heir to the Kennedy legacy, the most liberal of all the senators, and they want his endorsement. The Clintons desperately want the endorsement. Obama wants the endorsement. And they start a series of telephone calls just before the South Carolina primary, and between the Clintons, basically Ted Kennedy and the Clintons. And they become very anxious, very angry, very emotional. And in the end, of course, Kennedy endorses Obama, and that propels him, that locks it in for him.
Haynes Johnson, Dan Bolt, The Battle for America, 2008.
It's amazing, folks. It's really beautiful.
The music festival known as Woodstock kicked off 40 years ago this weekend.
You're all groovy, you know.
Backstage at Woodstock, next time on Bob Edwards Weekend, PRI, Public Radio International.
And that's coming up today at 2 on WAMU 88.5. Good morning, I'm Janine Herbst. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Tomorrow morning at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, it's your chance to participate in a live, civil town hall meeting about the healthcare debate. Experts answer your questions. Then, how a sandlot baseball game led a middle-class family to take in five boys from the projects. That's The Diane Rehm Show, tomorrow morning, Monday morning, at 10 on WAMU 88.5.
I want to tell you, as simply as I can, the story of how I made my decision of the heart. Those are the words of author Anne Rice. I'm Maureen Fiedler. Join me Sunday afternoon at 3 when I revisit my interview with this famous vampire novelist about her spiritual movement from atheism back to Catholicism. That's Interfaith Voices.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And we're talking about a new book, The Story of an Extraordinary Election. It's titled The Battle for America, 2008. Reporters Dan Bolt and Haynes Johnson are the co-authors. Here's the first email from Mike in Connecticut. He says, I contend the election was over in favor of Obama once McCain announced Sarah Palin as his running mate, once the public got a glimpse of her lack of experience and political knowledge, McCain was finished. Haynes.
Well, I would say yes and no. The first glimpse of her was tremendous. She generated enormous enthusiasm. McCain came back. He came back to lead in the polls after she became the nominee. And then she started sinking like this, just down. At the same time, the economy came along and he was doomed. McCain was doomed. But Palin did help. And then she, by her own ineptitude of those Katie Couric interviews, and it never really worked from that point on.
I think that's right. In the end, I don't think vice presidential candidates make a difference in the outcome. But there's no question that by the end of the campaign, she had lost the support and lost any affection among many of the voters that John McCain had hoped she would attract. There's no question she energized the Republican base.
Why did he choose her?
He was in a terrible strait. Their feeling was they needed to shake up the election, that with President Bush, as unpopular as he was, with the country wanting change, that the only thing that they could do to change the trajectory of a race that was heading toward Obama was to do something dramatic. And they saw in Sarah Palin, who was completely untested, obviously, someone who had run for governor in Alaska as a reform candidate. That appealed to McCain. She had taken on the establishment in Alaska. McCain was at heart a maverick who had taken on the establishment in Washington. And both he and several of his top advisors believed that if they picked her, they could reconstitute him as the maverick, as the real change candidate.
Tell me who brought Sarah Palin to McCain's attention.
Well, a combination of people. She was popular in conservative circles. She had done, right after she had gotten elected, she was heard that the Weekly Standard was doing a cruise to Alaska with some of the Weekly Standard editors and reporters, Bill Kristol and Fred Barnes among them. She invited them to an informal lunch. It was not a big formal gathering, but it was an informal lunch. She got to know them. I think it was an early sign of her own ambitions to be a player. But inside the campaign, two of the people who were most important in bringing her to the forefront were Rick Davis, the campaign manager, and Steve Schmidt, who was the senior advisor, both of whom believed that they had to do something dramatic.
But the thing about Palin was, and the Kristol visit to Alaska at that time was important because they came home really impressed with her. She was dynamic. She was a reformer. She was this and that. She was a woman. She was conservative. And they started writing things introducing her to the Republican base, not to the country, though. The country knew nothing about her, basically, until McCain picked her.
We all said, who's Sarah Palin?
Joe Biden said, who's that?
Yeah.
Just another one of these twists and turns.
All right, so look into your crystal ball. What kind of future does Sarah Palin have, Dan Balz?
Well, I think that depends on how she handles herself in what I would call this interim period, now that she is out of office. She has a lot of passion in terms of people who are part of the Republican base. There's no question about that. She has a following. I think the question is, does she have the seriousness of purpose and the depth of understanding of the issues to assure people that she's really up to the job? And what we've seen in the time since the campaign ended is that even many more Republicans have become disenchanted with her because they don't think she has demonstrated either a steadiness or a depth that they think is necessary.
All right, let's open the phones. We'll go first to Susan, who's in Houston, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the gentleman, given the fact that the subtitle of their book is The Battle for America, where do they see things going now in terms of more popular support for Obama? He has proved himself, I would say, to be kind of a pragmatic and a moderate who's even alienated some of his own Democratic base. He's kind of trying for collegiality and has tried for consensus across the aisle. I'm wondering whether he did just capture a moment or whether a lot of the young people who supported him and those Iowans who were largely white middle-class voters have any staying power?
Haynes.
I wish I could answer that question. We don't know. That's the unknown. We really don't know. It's now unfolding before us again. The one thing we do know, despite Obama's problems with policies, sinking poll numbers on this, he still retains the affection and support and confidence in a large the public. So that remains to be seen. Can they survive the difficulties? We'll know maybe 6 months from now, maybe a year from now. That's the question.
Dan?
One of the things I think that has surprised probably the president, I don't know that for sure, but certainly the people around him, is the degree to which the country repolarized after the election. I think they felt that, if you go back to election night, there was a feeling of pride in America. It was almost as if it didn't matter whether you had voted for Obama or not, people recognized that the election of the first African-American was a signal moment in American history, and I think a lot of people took pride in that. Certainly John McCain expressed it that night. President Bush did in the days after, and as did many Republicans. I think that the president believed that that sense of spirit that came out of the election, as well as the severity of the problems that he was taking on, would bring people together to try to find solutions. And instead, what we've seen is that Democrats and Republicans are at each other's throats as they had been before. That has made it much more difficult for him to govern. And I don't know whether there is an easy way out on that.
Here is an email which says, I don't think your guests are giving the media all the credit they deserve for Obama's election. They fell in love with him. They're still in love with him. They don't hammer him for things they would have attacked George W. Bush for. For example, the slowdown in cleanup of Superfund. They love the idea of Barack Obama rather than examining the reality of him.
Well, there's no question that Obama got a great press. People were intrigued by him for good reasons, too. Here he was, this guy coming out of nowhere, African-American, middle name Hussein, coming after 9/11, all that. That was really quite a test for the country. At the same time, I think that the media did not elect Barack Obama. The country, don't forget, by mid-September, the polls showed at that point McCain was ahead with Palin. And then the economy collapsed, Palin went into the tank, and McCain did not handle those debates well. And at that point, I don't think he had a chance. But it was not the media that caused those problems.
I'd also say I think that presidents get tough coverage as they run into problems. And I think what you've seen in the last, I would say, 45 to 60 days, a turn in the press coverage, that it has gotten tougher about him, and I think it will continue to be.
All right, to Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Good morning, Frank.
Hello, Diane?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
Hey, I got to make two quick points.
Sure.
I think President Obama should look long-term as far as the health care. Let's fast forward to 2082. I don't know if you've seen it, Diane, but I've seen on websites by 2082, the cost of health care across the country, rich and poor, is going to be 50% of the GDP. Right now it's about going headed toward 10 or 12%. And my second, these are going to look like the good old days in that respect. And my second point is I think John McCain would have been better served if he'd have picked Condoleezza Rice as his running mate. He might have had a better shot against Obama.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Haynes.
Well, I'm not sure about 2082. That's a little ahead of my time. But no question, there are tremendous problems the country faces, the president faces. Healthcare is among them, and that's not the only one. So this is evolving. We don't know. As far as Condoleezza Rice, maybe. Who knows? We don't know.
I think if he had picked Condoleezza Rice, he would have created a big problem for himself, which was to tie himself even more closely to President Bush. And they were looking for ways to separate from President Bush rather than tie themselves even closer.
Here's an email from Patty in Rochester, Michigan, who says, members of my family are disappointed in the president's presentation of the health care issue to the nation. They want him to speak as strongly as he did during the presidential campaign regarding this issue. They say he sounds weak on this issue.
Well, I think one of the problems he's run into, Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York, always liked to say politicians campaign in poetry and govern in prose. And I think that we're seeing that with President Obama. This is an enormously complex issue. And it is an issue in which if people are opposed to one element or another, they can elevate that into a major battle. And what has happened is that President Obama has had to spend a lot of time answering specific criticisms about elements that may or may not end up in the final bill. It is hard for him to reach the sort of the altitude that he hit as a candidate when he spoke in the broad strokes and talked about the the crisis that we faced, as opposed to down in the weeds now on these issues. And so I can understand why people who were drawn to him as a candidate may find it disappointing to watch him in this fight.
And everybody is involved in health care. Everybody. It's all of us, no matter what's going to happen. And then the issues of what's going to happen, it's to no way of knowing at this point. It's so complicated, so difficult, and this is the hard issue for all of us.
But there is a House bill out there, yes, even though there is no Senate bill yet.
Yeah. Well, it's very hard. We don't even have the language of these bills yet.
Yeah.
And so all this is coming about in a very quick time, and yet the country looks at it, and they're anxious. They know the economy is,
sure,
in trouble, and if you've lost your job, if you've been laid off, you might lose your benefits. So, and is it going to cost me or not cost me? People don't know that, and it's very difficult.
But doesn't he have to come out and say what he wants?
Well, there is a lot of pressure on him to do that, and there has been for a couple of months. And they have made the decision that the sooner he did that, the more he would become the target for specific kinds of criticism. But I think we are now at a point where he has to, at a minimum, bring the Democrats together. We've seen the last month Democrats versus Democrats on this, in addition to Republican opposition to it. That has made for a real problem for him and the party, and he's going to have to try to solve that.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Richard in Haverhill, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Yes, Diane. Although there's legitimate questions in opposition to the health care bill, I think there's a certain element in the Republican Party and the right-wing talk masters that really want to bring Barack Obama down. I mean, Senator James, a man, he said that we'd like to see his health care bill be Obama's Waterloo. I also think there's a certain element of race in this, too. All this anger and shrillness at these meetings, not with everybody, but I think it's with some people, it's an awakening to them that, gee, this is a Afro-American family in this White House. And I think, to some extent, race is playing into that. And I think that's why that polarization somewhat is back, like Dan was saying. I'd like Dan and Haynes to comment, please.
Well, the polarization is there, and it doesn't seem it's going to go away. And the great challenge for this president is to see if he can rise above it and persuade people to stick with his program. And he's got to explain it better. I think that's true, too. So this is not the easy solution that a president faces. He's got a tremendous task ahead of him. This is the most difficult political issue any politician can face, and it's growing worse because of the economy.
And this race issue goes back to one you take up at great length in the book, Jeremiah Wright, and how that whole discussion affected people's thinking about Barack Obama, Dan.
It was the most perilous moment in the entire campaign for Barack Obama, and he recognized that. The minute those videos came forth, ABC was the first to unearth them. And Obama instantly understood that if he did not handle this properly, he might well lose. He told us that in an interview some months after the whole episode had played out. For him, it was difficult for two reasons. One obviously was, as he said, it put the country back into a whole conversation about the tenuousness of racial relations in this country. As far as America has come since the days of Selma, to the days of Barack Obama being able to run for president, there's no question that race was and is still a divisive issue. And the Jeremiah Wright moment brought that to the forefront in a campaign that Barack Obama had tried to run as a post-racial candidate. He had not run on race.
It also gave him the opportunity to present one of the most effective speeches throughout that campaign.
Yes, his speech on race was historic, and his candidacy on race was historic. And I think what Dan said earlier, we look back to the election night. The country, whatever you felt, you had to say this was a proud moment for America. And it, not supporting Obama or McCain, that the country had risen above not all of racial problems, but they voted for African-American, and it put aside some past of our history that was troubling.
And what was finally the image to the world of Barack Obama's election?
Well, I think it signaled a new moment for America in the world, and certainly that was his belief. Solving these problems is still very, very difficult, the world's problems that he's taken on. He went to Africa in the summer of 2006, and he came back convinced that he was certainly thinking of being elected president at some point, that if he were elected, the world would begin to look at America differently. And I think that he was convinced of that throughout the election.
Dan Baltz, Haynes Johnson. The book is titled The Battle for America, 2008, and what an extraordinary story it is. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And congratulations.
Thanks for listening, all.
I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5, and it's a poetry compilation show with a remembrance of Hadrian Carruth and a poem by and a song for Kenneth Rexroth. Plus, we'll hear from various songwriters and poets, including Elvis Costello, Brad Paisley, Nellie McKay, and Nick Lowe. That's a Prairie Home Companion coming up next at 11. And tomorrow morning at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, your chance to participate in a live civil town hall meeting about the healthcare debate. Experts and analysts answer your questions. Then, how a sandlot baseball game led a middle-class family to take in five boys from the projects. The Diane Rehm Show, tomorrow morning at 10 on WAMU 88.5.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Asundio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
Not having health insurance and access to primary medical care can lead to higher rates of hospitalization, long-term care, disability, and mortality.
Georgetown University Hospital's Kids Mobile Medical Clinic provides free primary pediatric care and referrals to specialists each week. It accepts patients.